And again, thank you all for coming, and in many cases for coming again. As a lot of you know, in the first lecture I raised the question, what is it to be a self like us, to be distinctively human, and suggested that whatever the answer is, the identification of being a self like us with rational agency was inadequate. And then I explored that somewhat further in the next lecture by thinking about the ability to create art that could move us or interest us in certain ways as one example of what a self like us could do that might not connect particularly closely to rational agency. Today I'm going to try to connect these ideas with the idea of character, thus the beginning. I should warn all of you who have so nicely attended these lectures that after today, the PowerPoints will be much drier. Mostly words after today, unless I can think of some really great illustrations between now and tomorrow. References to character play a role in a great deal of philosophical discussion. The notion of character is fundamental to any study of virtue and vice. It's frequently invoked in discussions of the self, and comes up often in discussions of freedom and responsibility. In ethics, Bernard Williams has criticized both Kantian and consequentialist moral theories for failing to recognize the moral and psychological significance of individual characters. And some philosophers, impressed by the findings of situationist psychology, have raised doubts about whether the notion of character has any application at all. But despite the relatively frequent appeals to the notion of character in philosophy, remarkably little attention has been paid to the concept itself. And when philosophers have taken the trouble to define it, they've defined it in different ways. I don't want to legislate or revise ordinary language, or to claim that there is a right way to define the notion, much less propose a definition of character with necessary and sufficient conditions. But if it is playing a role in philosophical inquiry, it's important that we understand what we mean in its particular context. Although the term is often used broadly to encompass most of a person's psychological traits, there is a narrower and more robust sense of character that I think is relevant to a number of the philosophical issues in discussion of which the word is invoked, but whose difference from the broader and thinner sense tends to go unnoticed. My aim today is to bring out the distinction and to consider how best to understand the more robust sense of the term. If I'm right about the distinction and its relevance to our self-understanding, it will have implications for the way we think about many other concepts, including reason, intelligence, value, and the self. Especially interesting, I think, are the implications of this understanding of character for the way we should come to think about agency and its importance. Specifically, it will imply that agency, in a sense of great significance to us, has less to do with actions and with the will than is typically assumed. The OED lists 15 senses of character, most of them familiar, beginning with a distinctive mark impressed, engraved, or otherwise made on a surface, and ending with an odd, extraordinary, or eccentric person. The sense closest to what interests us here, particularly in connection with an individual's character, is listed as number 9 and reads, "The sum of the moral and mental qualities which distinguish an individual or a people viewed as a homogeneous whole. A person's or group's individuality deriving from environment, culture, experience, etc., mental or moral constitution, personality." Helpful as the OED so often is, however, it neither aims at nor achieves philosophical clarity. And in this case, this allegedly single definition is either inconsistent or ambiguous. For the sum of the moral and mental qualities which distinguish an individual embraces a wider range of features of a person's overall psychology than does the single term personality, or at least so it seems to me. The former presumably would include a catalog of a person's psychological abilities, her level of intelligence, her facility with languages, her poor or excellent memory, as well as any psychological disorders she might have, such as Tourette's syndrome or anorexia. But it is unlikely that we would consider these parts of the person's personality. Further, even if personality, which is the narrower use of the narrower of these terms, seems broader than or at least different, right, personality seems broader than or at least different from the sense of character I have in mind. For although there are some contexts in which people may comfortably and naturally use character and personality interchangeably, it seems to me that when we are speaking precisely and concretely, we don't use the words personality and character in quite the same way. If you're asked to describe someone, whether yourself or another person, or to answer the question, what is so-and-so like, you may well list features of the person's personality, and of course it wouldn't be out of place to describe the person's physical characteristics as well. But if one is asked instead, who is this person really, you're apt to focus on a narrower set of qualities, which are more likely to be classified as aspects of the person's character. We're more likely to describe someone as having a bubbly personality than a bubbly character, to regard her liking for country music or her taste for bright colors as reflecting her personality rather than as a sign of her character. Virtues and vices, on the other hand, are paradigmatic aspects of a person's character. More broadly, we tend to associate a person's character with dispositions and qualities that embody or display that person's values. In general, I would venture to say, we tend to use the term character in connection with features of a person that are regarded as especially important or deep, and to use personality in connection with many of the person's other distinguishing traits. This seems to square well with the use of the term in most philosophical discussions, but since usage varies and people differ in any case about which features they regard as especially important or deep, we cannot make too much of ordinary linguistic practice. While my aim is to offer an analysis of character that gives a plausible interpretation of much of our unreflective use of that term, I also want to illuminate some of the uses philosophers have made of it. Specifically, I'm interested in understanding character as a term closely related to a person's core identity and as referring to those features that distinguish one person from others in ways that are important at least to people with whom they are or might be in close personal relationships. If one cares about oneself, I want to say, one has reason to care about one's character. And if one cares deeply and personally about someone else, one has reason to care about their character too. Further, I'm inclined to say that insofar as one relates to people as people, one implicitly relates to them as individuals who have characters, or who, at the very least, have the capacity to develop characters. But what can the term character mean that will allow me to say all these things? Philosophers and others are apt to regard virtues and vices as aspects of one's character, if anything is. More particularly, they often associate character with specifically moral virtues and vices. Peter Goldie, one of the few philosophers who has explicitly proposed a distinction between personality and character, writes that character traits are deeper than personality traits and are concerned with a person's moral worth. And the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy's only entry on character is more precisely an entry on moral character. But if we're looking for a sense of character that embraces whatever is especially deep, important, and distinctive about a person, something closely related to a person's core identity, referring to those features that distinguish one person from others in ways that are important to their candidacy for close personal relationships, then restricting the range of traits to those that are specifically moral is too narrow. To be sure, a person's moral qualities are often of great interest to us, and many people, thankfully, do regard their moral values and their commitment to expressing and living in accordance with them as deep and important features of themselves. But to think that this is all that people cherish or despise in themselves, or all that they regard as deep facts about themselves and each other, grossly exaggerates the role moral values play in most people's lives and self-conceptions. Morality itself is, of course, open to narrower and broader construals. Such traits as pretentiousness, arrogance, tactlessness, and self-centeredness are at least broadly moral vices, even if they are strictly compatible with an individual's moral righteousness, since they reflect a person's attitude towards herself relative to others that is in tension with moral ideals. Executive virtues and vices, too, such as courage and cowardice, industriousness and laziness, might also be considered as at least relevant to morality because they have significant implications for a person's performance when morally important challenges arise. But even when we interpret morality broadly and generously, the range of qualities that constitute a person's specifically moral character will leave out much that people take to be deep and important aspects of their own characters, and much of what matters to us about the characters of others. Speaking for myself, the knowledge that an individual possessed all the moral virtues, or that at any rate she was an exceptionally impressive moral exemplar, would not make me love her or seek her out as a friend, though it would make me admire her. For she might, for all that, be boring or humorless. Nor would the fact that a person had significant moral flaws necessarily exclude her from candidacy for such relationships. People might reasonably pride themselves and be prized by others for their adventurous spirit, their intellectual curiosity, their passionate engagement with nature or the arts. This suggests that a definition of character that relates it to reflections of a person's values generally, and not only or especially to the person's moral values, will get closer to the sense of the term we are after. An interpretation of character as especially connected to a person's values, also makes sense of Bernard Williams' use of character and of many philosophers' identification of a person's character with their real self. Williams' use of character seems to identify a person's character with their ground projects, or at least to regard their ground projects as comprising an especially important part of their character. And by ground projects, Williams refers to those activities or relationships that are closely related to a person's existence and which, to a significant degree, give a meaning to his life. A person's relationship to her children or her career or to a non-professional interest about which she is passionate might thus count as among her ground projects in Williams's sense, as important to her sense and perhaps other sense of who she is and of her reasons to live as anything. Much as I support Williams' emphasis on the importance of a person's ground projects to moral psychology and moral theory, however, and loath as I am to disagree with anything Williams says, I confess that I find this use of character linguistically odd and unfortunate. Indeed, it seems a misuse of language to say that when a person loses one of her ground projects, say her beloved partner dies in a plane crash, or her carpal tunnel syndrome ends her career as a violinist, her character necessarily changes. The facts that she had these ground projects rather than some others, that she had them in the specific ways she did, and that she responds in the particular ways she does to their loss, do typically reflect her character, and indeed, the loss of one of these ground projects may, depending on the details, lead gradually to a change in character. But they are not themselves parts of her character. Still, if we think of character roughly as those dispositions and traits that reflect and express an individual's values, then the fact that our ground projects do reflect and express our values allows us at least to connect a person's ground projects with character in a way that conforms better to ordinary language. This use of character also fits well with the tendency among philosophers to identify a person's character with her real self, and to identify her real self, in turn, with those aspects of herself with which she identifies and which she either does or would, on reflection, endorse. For on at least one familiar way of understanding what it is for someone to value something, valuing is connected precisely to identification and reflective endorsement. Useful as it may be to have a term for such a concept, however, I do not think it succeeds in capturing enough of our ordinary linguistic practices to be a good definition of character. Nor will it do if we want to retain the connection between a person's character and what we regard as deep and important about the person. In one respect, I believe, this characterization of character is insufficiently specific. In another, I believe it is too narrow. Let me begin with the latter. One natural way to understand the proposal to understand character as composed of those traits which reflect a person's values is by thinking of character as simply consisting in an individual's values or valuational system, together with those behavioral and emotional dispositions that reflect and express them. But on this view, it appears that a person's character can include only aspects of herself of which she approves. This seems clearly wrong, since vices and other character flaws are as much a part of someone's character as virtues and other admirable character traits. And although there are some cases in which what we regard as a vice is endorsed by the person who possesses it, think, for example, of Gordon Gekko's comment, "Greed is good," or of Ayn Rand's doctrine of objectivism, there are many others in which a person whom we correctly judge to be, say, selfish or arrogant or racist would agree with our assessment that such qualities are to be condemned. Such a person may not recognize these character traits in herself, and if she did, she may not endorse them. But disavowing a character trait does not make it disappear. The range of forms of racism, sexism, and other sorts of prejudice and bias that are aspects of people's characters may be particularly resistant to an analysis that links all character traits to reflection of a person's values. Admittedly, there are unapologetic racist, sexist, and bigots of other sorts, people who not only regard one ethnic group or gender, say, as intrinsically superior to another, but who are, at least privately, unashamed of this. But there are many other forms of racism and sexism that are harder to classify. Even some very blatant types of prejudice are not easily interpreted as reflections of a person's value. There's clearly something wrong with the person who says sincerely, "I'm not a racist, it's just a fact that blacks are statistically less intelligent than whites," or, "I'm not a sexist, I just believe that women should be women and men should be men." But is what's wrong a matter of their values? If we understand values to involve an actual or hypothetical judgment that the object of value is good, it's not obvious to me what values such racist or sexist remarks reveal. Furthermore, people frequently value or disvalue features in each other that the person herself doesn't realize she has. And she may have no opinion at all about the value either of her possession of these features or of the objects on which they focus. One may be charmed by another's lack of awareness of her own beauty or brilliance, for example, or by a person's unselfconscious quirkiness. Or consider someone with a philosophical turn of mind, whose interest and enthusiasm for certain kinds of questions and conversations, whose reactions to novels, plays, and current events reflect a tendency to approach and respond to the world with a particular kind of intellectual curiosity. Those of us who, one way or another, came to recognize this as an interest in philosophy, who went on to major in the subject, to seek out philosophy lectures and books, or even to become professional academic philosophers, presumably do value philosophy and our relationship to it. But we can easily imagine someone who never knew that the sorts of questions he liked to contemplate were philosophical ones, who never realized, in fact, that there were particular sorts of questions he was interested in that set him apart from others, though he may have noticed that people sometimes looked at him funny and found him a little weird. It seems to me that having a philosophical turn of mind is a quintessential example of an aspect of someone's character, a deep and distinctive feature of a person that can be important to what attracts or repels us from him. But to insist that it reveals the person's values, if values are to be linked to what a person does or would under ideal conditions endorse, is to project something onto his psychology that may not be there. I do not just mean that he may not value philosophy or his propensity to ponder philosophical questions under those particular descriptions, since he doesn't even know what philosophy is. I mean further that it would be unwarranted to assume that he has even a disposition to value it on reflection, should it be pointed out to him. It seems to me that his attitude towards his philosophical turn of mind might simply be indeterminate. Further, it seems to me that this example is an illustration of a tremendously common phenomenon. We know some things about our own characters and are probably self-deceived about some others. Like the well-known tendency of people to rate themselves as better drivers than they really are, most of us probably also tend to believe ourselves to have better characters than we actually have. But equally, there's much about our characters that we are simply unaware of. Features of our psychology that are so much a part of us that they are part of the background that shapes the way we see and respond to the world without ever being an object of our perception itself. Such features need be neither good nor bad, such as having a philosophical turn of mind, but they may well contribute to one's distinctive identity in a way that matters both unconsciously to oneself and either consciously or unconsciously to others. Speaking for myself, I like it this way. I do not really want to know what it is about me that makes some people like me and presumably makes others dislike me for being the particular person I am. Being too self-conscious about one's character can make one stiff and artificial, just like being self-conscious on the dance floor. Though I hope that I do not have a bad character, and I would want to know if I have flaws and vices that I ought to try to reduce, if I could find such things out without finding out everything else, good and neutral, that others see in me as making me who I am, I would prefer it. Ralph Waldo Emerson seems to be of a similar mind. The less a man thinks or knows about his virtues, the better we like him, he said. Though this attitude is not universal, the fact that it is intelligible lends support to the idea that our characters, in the sense I'm trying to elucidate, include more than the range of dispositions and attitudes that reflect and express our values, at least if values are identified with those things that we do or would, on reflection, endorse or judge to be good. Some aspects of our characters reflect attitudes and dispositions that we positively disvalue, and others reveal things about us that we have no opinion about. Thus, I propose that we understand character as consisting in the complex of those dispositions and tendencies that reflect and express our distinctive ways of seeing the world. By substituting our ways of seeing the world for our values, I mean to broaden the set of features that count as aspects of character beyond those things that reveal our evaluative judgments and de-emphasize the importance of whether the tendencies and dispositions that distinguish us are ones that we would endorse. But the phrase is vague and indeed metaphorical, and so, as a characterization of character, it needs to be supplemented, explained, and clarified. One point worth mentioning is that a complete description of our way of seeing the world, as I wish this to be understood, would not only include those features of the world that are salient to a person, and in what ways they are salient, it would also make evidence what features are not salient. Such absences can be of particular interest when they depart from the ways most people see the world, especially if one thinks there is something particularly good or bad about this lack. Thus, for example, inconsiderateness or thoughtlessness can be aspects of someone's character, most naturally understood in terms of someone's failure to see other people's needs or sensitivities. A certain kind of selflessness might consist in the fact that in certain sorts of circumstances, a person does not give much attention to her own welfare when deliberating about what to do. In addition, it should be clear that one's way of seeing the world does not solely refer to the literal exercise of one's sense organs, and that the world referred to is not restricted to the spatio-temporal physical world. If a person literally sees the world in black and white because his rods and cones are damaged, this tells us nothing about his character. But it is a part of someone's character that he sees the world in black and white in the metaphorical sense, which refers not just to his tendency to classify people and objects as either wholly good or bad, beautiful or ugly, for us or against us, but also to his approach and assessment of policies, principles, and ideas. Indeed, Although I have objected to identifying a person's character with the dispositions and tendencies that reflect the person's values as too narrow to embrace all that we typically include in the idea of character, that definition is on the right track in focusing not so much on what the person sees, but on the way he sees it, on what he sees it as, in a way that marks different objects and ideas in evaluative, affective, and conative ways. To value or disvalue something is, at least in part, to see it as relatively good or bad, worthy or unworthy. As a person goes through life, encountering people, places, and objects, confronted by challenges, making judgments and choices, her values have much to do with the way she sees and responds to the world. But she also sees things, both actual and possible, three-dimensional and conceptual, as more or less attractive or repellent, which is not the same as good or bad, valuable or disvaluable, interesting or boring, amusing, surprising, chilling, and so on. Like values, these ways of seeing structure and light up the world of her thought in variegated ways. And it is the unconscious, largely integrated, though not necessarily rationally coherent, complex of these ways of seeing things, of seeing, thinking, and feeling, that express themselves in fairly deep set and stable dispositions and tendencies that comprise what I am calling one's character. Thinking again of the racist, who neither approves of racism nor recognizes it in herself, we can see how the broader, if vaguer and less precise characterization of character helps us explain how racism can be a part of her character without it being a part of her values. It is because of something about the way she sees people of different races and which is reflected in her reactions to them that she is a racist, whether she wants to be this way or knows she is this way or not. Thinking again of the unself-conscious proto-philosopher and his philosophical turn of mind also illustrates and confirms the aptness of this broader characterization. For there's nothing about the example as I have described it that warrants the conclusion that the individual does or would see anything good about the fact that he finds himself interested in such fundamental questions as the objectivity of values or the meaning of life. As I said before, he may not notice that he has this tendency, and if he does notice, he might just shrug it off with the thought, this is just how I am. Indeed, depending on his social environment, he may find this feature of himself embarrassing and regrettable. The philosophers in the audience might think back on how they felt about themselves in high school. But the fact that certain kinds of events lead him to ask certain kinds of questions, that he's drawn to certain kinds of books and movies and conversations, that his imagination follows certain paths and not others, are symptoms of a deep-seated and stable tendency that tells us something important about him, important at least to people with whom he is or might be in a close personal relationship. That is, it tells us something about his character, as I'm using that term, something that I want to include in the admittedly imprecise but suggestive phrase, his way of seeing the world. A difference between the definition of character I have rejected and the one that I'm proposing that has not yet been emphasized is the change from understanding character to refer to a set of dispositions and tendencies to understanding it as a complex of dispositions and tendencies. The first characterization suggests that one's character consists in some or all of one's character traits, which at first glance might appear plausible and unsurprising. But talk of a complex of dispositions and tendencies seems to refer to something more integrated or unified. This unification seems almost required by the shift from a description of character in terms of values to ones that reflect how an individual sees the world. For while it is perfectly natural and straightforward to speak of a person's values and the dispositions or character traits that express them one at a time, it is awkward and peculiar to try to divide one's way of seeing the world into separable components. The unity of consciousness that characterizes people of moderately good mental health is such that their evaluative, affective, and conative dispositions interact and blend in ways that seem to yield a single perspective or point of view. I don't mean to say that people's ways of seeing the world are necessarily rationally coherent or even consistent. A person may be attracted to something that she does not value, bored by something in which she thinks she ought to take an interest. Nor do I mean to suggest that people's points of view and their characters cannot change over time. People can grow cynical or get religion or become more or less politically conservative over time. But even rationally incoherent thoughts and feelings can contribute to a single perspective, which might be reflected in elements of ambivalence and confusion that are part of a person's way of seeing the world. Once the shift from conceiving of character as a collection of traits to understanding it more holistically has been made, it seems an improvement. For while honesty is presumably a character trait and an aspect of someone's character, a person who is honest and tactful is honest in a different way than one who is honest and tactless. Her honesty is shaped in part by her tact, or lack of it, as it is by other aspects of her character, such as, for example, her attention to detail. Perhaps this is why it can seem so difficult to describe the people we love in a way that could explain to someone else what it is that makes us love her, and why it is hard to imagine two people with exactly the same character, even though there is nothing about the idea of character that makes it conceptually impossible. When we reflect on the characters of people we know, or of what we mean when we refer to their characters, it seems that no list of traits, however large, will fully capture who they are. Thus, it appears that a person's character is more than or other than a collection of traits. Understanding character as a complex of dispositions and tendencies that reflect a person's way of seeing the world implicitly seems to accommodate this point in a way that the earlier characterization that I considered does not. Still, the characterization of character I have proposed remains too vague to ward off certain interpretations of what it is to have a character that I want to reject. For presumably, non-human animals as well as people might have distinctive ways of seeing the world, reflected in a complex of dispositions and tendencies. And yet I do not believe that non-human animals, at least most of them, have characters of the kind that matter to us so much in interpersonal relations. Furthermore, mental disorders, phobias, obsessions, and addictions, for example, presumably figure into the ways those who have them see the world, just as much as do values and tastes. But as I've already mentioned, we do not regard these as aspects of the person's character. So we need to add something to our understanding of character that will rule these interpretations out. It might be noted that the characterization of character that I rejected, which associates character with the dispositions and tendencies that reflect an individual's values, avoids these problems. For presumably, non-human animals do not have values. Although they are attracted to some things and averse to others, they cannot judge them more or less worthy of attraction. And mental disorders do not, as a rule, indicate anything about their victims' values. Famously, being addicted to a drug does not imply that you value either the drug or your consumption of it. Having a compulsion to steal is compatible with strongly disapproving of theft. By broadening the definition in a way that weakened the association of character with the reflection of an individual's values, something important to what we mean by character seems to have been lost. But what exactly? It cannot be the connection to value itself, if we want to retain and vindicate the intuition that such traits as racism or snobbery can be aspects of a person's character, even if the person doesn't value these things or value something else that is specifically implied by these traits. But the following thought experiment might suggest something implicit in our thought that is at least contingently related to valuing. Imagine a dog that has been conditioned to respond differently to people according to the color of their skin. It is trained, let's imagine, to growl and even act aggressively towards dark-skinned people, but not light-skinned people. Is the dog racist? Although its behavior is clearly discriminatory, it seems to me highly misleading to use that term. And yet, if we think people who discriminate in such ways may be racist, even if they don't endorse racism or value light skin, It cannot be the difference between valuing and not valuing that explains our different responses. Intuitively, it seems wrong to consider the dog racist because the dog is incapable of understanding what racism is. Although it can be trained, that is, conditioned, to respond differently to people with different skin tones, its behavior cannot mean what it means when human beings exhibit racist tendencies. The dog cannot understand the very idea of race or form the thought that some people are inferior to others, nor, a fortiori, can it consider whether and why such a thought would be wrong. By contrast, if a person living in 21st century America or England has dispositions to react differently to blacks and to whites, it's reasonable to assume that she does see blacks and whites as belonging to different races, that she sees them as correspondingly different in objectionable ways, and that she has the mental capacities to question these dispositions, both morally and descriptively. I do not mean to insist that such a person has control over these dispositions, certainly not that she can change them at will. Whether she's accountable and blameworthy for her racism, and if so, how blameworthy she is, are further questions, the answer to which may depend on additional facts. And as it happens, I will be touching on that issue in tomorrow's lecture. The present point is simply that the judgment that an individual is racist, where this is understood to refer to an aspect of the individual's character, involves more than the observation that she has a psychological disposition to react differently to people or of different skin tones. It involves an assumption that the disposition in question reflects a certain kind of understanding that gives the disposition the meaning it has. Some philosophers might want to paraphrase this point by saying that a disposition can only be racist if it is reasons responsive. And indeed, Peter Goldie has suggested that reasons responsiveness is a criterion of aspects of character quite generally. They might claim that the difference between a dog's being trained to respond differently to individuals with different skin tones and a child's being taught to do this is that the dog's behavior is merely a product of operant conditioning while the child is given reasons. Similarly, they might note that mental disorders are notoriously not responsive to reasons. If a person has a phobia, for example, her fear will not be responsive to the knowledge that the object of her fear poses no danger. If a person is a literally pathological liar, then her disposition to lie will not be sensitive to whether lying is apt to bring her benefit or harm. Thus, they might say, the feature of reasons responsiveness explains the difference between dispositions that are part of one's character and those, like mental disorders, that are not. But the philosophical terminology of reasons responsiveness is ambiguous and potentially misleading. Understood one way, it's not clear why traits acquired by operant conditioning would not be considered reasons responsiveness. For a dog is rewarded for treating blacks and whites differently, doesn't that count as a reason to do so? And if new training rewards him for reversing or modifying these behavior patterns, isn't the dog responding to reasons to change? If, on the other hand, reasons responsiveness is defined so as definitively to exclude such conditioning, then it becomes unclear why the sort of unconscious and unintentional racism we've been talking about should be considered reasons responsive. For the sorts of thoughts and patterns that tend to constitute racism and sexism of this sort are typically not taught explicitly through the offering of reasons by parents, teachers, and peers. They are rather picked up, absorbed from our cultures in subtle, subliminal ways. Moreover, such thoughts and patterns are not readily susceptible to change, either as a result of our better judgment or of our will. Nonetheless, there is a difference between what the dog's conditioned behavior shows us about the dog and what the human being's acculturated responses show us about her. Insofar as the suggestion to regard reasons responsiveness as a criterion of character is meant to capture those differences, it's on a right track. The acculturated racist, I want to say, has acquired a way of seeing blacks and whites that is different from what the dog has acquired. There is a kind of understanding, albeit a misunderstanding, manifest in the responses of the racist that is absent in the dog. And although the acculturated racist may neither endorse her dispositions to discriminate nor be able directly and immediately to control them, she is, at least in principle, capable of changing with respect to them over time as a result of coming to understand and appreciate the significance and insignificance of race differently from what her dispositions currently reflect. I shall put this by saying that the racist dispositions are infused with and informed by an active intelligence. That they are infused with intelligence is meant to specify that they are shaped by and reflect understandings of race that involve concepts and content she has come to acquire through a combination of thought and experience. That they are informed by an active intelligence is meant to add that these dispositions are subject to continued change by further thought and new experience, as well as by the gradual effects over time of thought and experience already present and past. It is worth stressing that the thought includes not only the exercise of reason, but also that of perception, imagination, empathy, and whatever other faculties contribute to our understanding and appreciation of the world around us. In arguing for the relevance of active intelligence in determining whether a disposition or trait is an aspect of character, I've used the contrast between the acculturated racist and the dog in order to avoid the tendency to think that the relevant difference between aspects of character and other psychological traits is essentially related to whether or not the agent values or endorses the dispositions and judgments at issue. But when we turn our attention to dispositions and traits that are endorsed by their agents, and to patterns of judgments, desires, and responses that on standard accounts would be regarded as constituting an individual's values, the relevance of active intelligence in differentiating aspects of a person's character from other features of her psychology remains. Consider, for example, the difference between a man whom we would intuitively describe as possessing the virtue of honesty and one who, perhaps as a result of brainwashing or of a pathological desire to please his father, has acquired a strong disposition to tell the truth. Let us assume that the second man, as well as the first, approves of this feature of his psychology. Both have not only a desire to tell the truth, but a second-order desire that the first desire be effective. Both not only want to tell the truth, but also judge that truth-telling is good. But the first person must have some, not necessarily articulate, understanding or appreciation of why truth-telling is good that will give contours to his value in truth and truth-telling that the second will not have. So that the honest person, that is the one who has the virtue of honesty, will not be moved by his value in truth to reveal to his father-in-law that a surprise party is being planned for him that evening, much less to direct the Nazi at the door to the Jewish neighbor hiding in his attic. On some, perhaps most philosophical accounts of what it is to value something and of what counts as an aspect of character, both men would qualify as valuing truth and as having honest characters. I prefer to describe them differently, and to say of the second man that he has at best a feature that simulates honesty. But however one wants to describe these individuals, I hope it's clear that to anyone involved or potentially involved with these individuals in a close personal relationship, there's an enormous difference between them of more than instrumental importance. This is what I had in mind when I said in my comments about Proposal 2 that it was at once too narrow and insufficiently specific. To sum up, I've proposed a definition of character as the complex of dispositions and traits that reflect and express an individual's way of seeing the world, a definition that is meant to answer to a sense of character that takes one's character to be closely related to one's core identity, sometimes referred to as one's real or deep self. According to this definition, one's character is not restricted to the reflection of interests and dispositions that one does or would endorse. It is rather distinguished by its constituting a response to the world, broadly construed, that involves the exercise of an active intelligence, where the concept of intelligence itself is not to be understood as equivalent to reason and rationality. It's worth noting that one who accepts this definition and takes it to heart is apt to give a much less central place to the role of intentions and will than current philosophical theories do in their conceptions of what is important about people. For although one's character, as I've defined it, both shapes and is shaped by one's will in important ways, there's also much that is not intentional or voluntary that is significant in determining one's character, and there are many ways in which one's character reveals itself other than through one's intentional acts. In developing the conception of character that I have, and in trying to make it plausible to you, I've tried to bring out the extent to which our intuitive and pre-reflective thoughts and responses to ourselves and each other include non-intentional, non-voluntary, and non-endorsed features of our outlooks and dispositions in our sense of our identities in actual practice. We sometimes do acknowledge that there are deep aspects of our psychology that we didn't and wouldn't choose and that are not under our control. And perhaps more often, we take seriously aspects of other people's psychologies that they did not choose and may not even recognize. When we talk of someone's character, I believe, we often implicitly invoke a concept that includes such features, even if we are not self-conscious about it, and despite the fact that philosophical accounts of character that may initially appear attractive often exclude such features from their analyses. But more importantly, I've wanted to present an outlook in which our taking such features of ourselves seriously, as features of our identities, which are our appropriate basis for admiration and criticism, pride and shame, love, friendship, and hostility, is not just familiar, but appealing, or, to put it more bluntly, right and good. That is to say, my main concern is to make not a linguistic, but an evaluative point. However one chooses to use the term character, there is good reason to acknowledge and take responsibility for such features of ourselves, for our way of seeing the world, and for the ways our outlooks show themselves in practice, whether or not we approve of these features, and whether or not they are under our control. And there are good reasons, too, to care about these features of others, particularly of others with whom we do or may frequently interact, and with whom we may have close and intimate relationships. The fact that a person values or chooses or endorses some aspect of herself, or that she intends and approves of something she has done, does and should make some difference to us, at least in contexts in which our feelings and judgments about her are at stake. But it often does, and I believe should, make less difference, both a less strong and a less pervasively relevant difference, than many common philosophical conceptions of personhood and responsibility suggest. It's important to keep in mind, however, that while my conception of character is broader than some standard accounts, insofar as it includes non-moral as well as moral traits, and is not confined to aspects of a person that she endorses or that are under her control, it also specifies the sorts of traits and aspects of a person that contribute to her character in a way that might be said to raise the threshold of what counts as an aspect of character, and even of what it takes to have a character at all. I'm referring to the idea that one's way of seeing the world must be informed by and infused with an active intelligence, such that it is continually, though not necessarily controllably, subject to change in light of one's ongoing experience and reflection. Without this condition, the idea that one's identity is not determined or confined by one's will or one's approval might seem to depreciate the significance of one's agency. It might seem that, on my account, a person could be programmed to believe or to want certain things or to see the world in a certain way. To put it another way, it might seem that a person could have certain beliefs, desires, ways of seeing the world implanted in her, whether by her upbringing or by a mad neuroscientist, and that this would be sufficient to make these states features of her core identity or character, in my sense. Such an account seems to allow that a person might be passive with respect to her character or core identity. And it might be thought that it was precisely in order to reject this possibility that philosophers like Frankfurt and Korsgaard have insisted that one's core identity be restricted to features of oneself that one has in some way chosen or embraced. But if the condition, or better, the specification, that one's way of looking at things must be informed by or infused with an act of intelligence is understood properly, one can see that this interpretation of my account must be rejected. For the exercise of active intelligence is, as its label suggests, active, not passive. One can perhaps conceive of a being with active intelligence having a desire or belief implanted in him. One might, for example, be hypnotized or brainwashed or just socially conditioned to like Big Macs, for example, or to believe that women are less rational than men. If the individual is already fully developed, that belief or desire might be fully in line or harmonious with a host of their other beliefs, desires, and attitudes, or it might be quite anomalous or something in between. Whether the implanted state sticks and gets incorporated into the subject's way of seeing the world will depend on how they reflect, imagine, and otherwise respond to it as it clashes or reinforces other aspects of their way of seeing. If the individual is at an early stage of development, just coming to form a point of view of their own, the state in question will presumably be less strongly subjected to tests of coherence. It may therefore be more likely to take hold, at least for an initial period, and even to contribute to the addition or rejection of further beliefs, desires, and other dispositions. But still, if the subject is one with active intelligence and there's nothing peculiar about the state under consideration, it will not be permanently fixed, impervious to the challenges new experiences and thoughts might pose over time. To describe the subject, whether the already mature or still developing subject, as passive with respect to this process is misleading at best. This point can be missed if one identifies agency with the ability and disposition to act, and identifies action in turn with the exercise or choice of choice or will. Calling attention to what it is like for an individual to exercise active intelligence, however, should make one question this way of conceiving of agency and its opposite. Thinking and looking, listening, imagining are active states, even though we frequently do not choose or control whether we are engaged in them, nor choose or control what it is that we will think, see, etc. Yoga instructors sometimes instruct their clients to just let their thoughts float by and pass through their minds. That is, to be passive with respect to their thoughts. But the difficulty of doing this, or for some people, of even understanding what it would mean to do this, brings out the fact that the default way of thinking is not passive. It takes effort to disengage, and in many cases, it may be impossible to do so. Most of the time, I believe, we take for granted that when we ascribe a thought, desire, or value to a person, that thought, desire, or value is infused with active intelligence. When we describe someone as honest, for example, we assume that she not only has a desire to tell the truth, but some kind of understanding or sense of what is good about truth-telling, about how good it is relative to other values, how it affects people to be dealt with honestly or dishonestly, and how being honest or not affects the quality of one's relationships with other people. And it's reasonable to take this for granted, since it is almost always people to whom we are ascribing thoughts, values, and so on. And people are almost always actively intelligent creatures exercising their faculties of thinking, perceiving, etc., most of their waking lives. But because we take it for granted, we rarely notice it, and our philosophical accounts fail to mention it. Perhaps it is for this reason that the active-passive distinction and the corresponding idea of agency has been conceived as having so much to do with choice and will. The ability and tendency to exercise active intelligence might serve as a basis for a different conception of agency, one that is more distinctively human insofar as it distinguishes people's agency from that of many animals and conceivable machines. It seems to me that the possession of active intelligence and of characters that are infused with active intelligence marks the difference between beings whom I relate to with the participant stance as members of a common interpersonal community and others. That is, between selves like us and individuals who are not. For while beings who fail to have and exercise the set of faculties and skills that I'm referring to as active intelligence can have preferences and behavioral dispositions, these things cannot have the meanings they do when they form part of people's character, in my sense. Such beings can favor certain people, certain kinds or works of art, certain forms of activity over others. But they cannot be sexist or non-sexist, have good taste or bad, be virtuous or vicious, in senses which matter to one with whom one might be in relationship. To invoke Strawson's contrast between the participant attitude and the objective attitude toward other people, one can fight or negotiate with such individuals, but one cannot quarrel or reason with them. One can even love such individuals, but not with the kind of love that two adult human beings can sometimes be said to have reciprocally for each other. If we care about having distinctively human relationships, then it's important that we notice whether individuals have characters, in my sense. And of course, it is also important what characters they have.